All right, thank you, Hector. All right, it is now time for our main speaker. Please welcome Abby from Newport Beach.
All right, we need Abby, an alcoholic. Abby, alcoholic. I don't have a sobriety date of June 12th, 2023. All right, it is not my first sobriety date, but it's my first actual recovery date, because all those before, I had no idea. I really wasn't doing this deal. I have taken 1 year three times. I took 3 year once. I just took 2 years, and I have 741 days of continuous sobriety. All right. Welcome to the newcomers. I love it here. And I can't even believe I'm saying something like that. It's like, I'm so cynical, but I love this program. So if you're new, I hope you hear something, you see something, or you taste something that brings you back to the rooms, because I kept coming back. I just kept coming back. I have a sponsor, her name is Carrie, and she went before me because I want what she has. So I had to wait to see what she said to you guys so that I could say what she says. And she said, yeah, I love this woman, man. I love it. And she's just, thank goodness she does her primary purpose. Thank goodness she came here to get him sober. And I'm really like, I don't know what the hell Frankie Buffalino is doing, but I love that man, because his disease got this woman in the rooms of AA. She heard that hope from all of you. And she was 29 years sober when I asked her to be my sponsor. She'd been doing this deal for 29 years. And I walked in a room and I heard that hope. Let me tell you a little bit about myself before I talk about that day in April of 2018 when I found my God to a person. I grew up in a small town in West Virginia, Virginia. I came from the backwoods of West Virginia, and my dad was a coal miner. He's one of us. I am a coal miner's daughter, you guys. I'm a coal miner's daughter. That's right. And it's a small town life, you know. My dad was diagnosed with brain cancer around the time I was born. I have an older brother and sister. He was a coal miner, then had to go on disability because he was diagnosed with brain cancer. And he also was a born-again Christian in the 1980s. That performative, evangelical, speaking in tongues, that, you know, that loud, obnoxious, that TV-type evangelism that was more about performing and a scary God than it was about actual faith or, you know, coming, finding something that makes you feel good. Like, I was scared the fuck from that God. That God scared me to death. Because, girl, if you sinned, you're going to hell, don't you know? I was like, oh, dude. Like, it just was this very scary, fearful God, always telling me what I could not be, what I should not be. And if I am, I'm damned to hell. So very early on, I was sort of afraid to make mistakes. I was like, fuck, I don't want to do, I'm going to go there, right? And they just, my dad, bless his little heart, he's one of us. And so, you know, he just took that disease he had, and he was diagnosed with cancer, and he just thought God was going to save him, right? God was going to heal him. And everybody in that church told him, Brother Tim, if you just keep coming here and you keep tithing, let's get that tithing, right?
Yeah.
Give us your money, right, Brother Tim? You're going to be that miracle. And my dad was born, I mean, he literally lived with brain cancer. I mean, he had it my entire life. Well, not my entire life, until I was 11. he died. But that God didn't save him. But anyway, for all I knew, this man I know, with peace and love, Dad. But the point is, I grew up in a church where, like, God was very much in my life, because it's very much in my God, in my dad's life, because he knew what he was going to die from, and he was scared to death of dying. And so all he knew was that people were telling him he was going to go to hell, because he was like me. He was out there doing some nasty things in his disease, and I know he was, for sure. And I didn't experience that part of my dad, but I heard about it over the years, and I could see it in him in that behavior. But there was just like this sort of like unspoken contempt in my house, like the things that I know that my dad did to my mom before I got there, you know, that like it was still everlasting in the house, although they didn't speak about it. Like, I knew my parents did not love each other. I mean, one time I saw them hugging, and it was just the weirdest thing. I remember being like, yo, what are you doing? Right. So just like, I didn't have a like good relationship model for me. I just knew that they didn't really get along. They fought a little bit, but my dad was just one of those holy rollers. Like, he just felt that his goal in life, because he just wanted God to love him, was to bring people to God, right? And so he was on disability, and I did gymnastics. And so he would go to the gym, and he would clean my gym in order to help pay for my gymnastics lessons. And then we'd go to McDonald's. And in West Virginia, if you go to McDonald's, like, that is big time. I was so stoked about the Happy Meal and shit. I was like, yeah. And, you know, so we'd go through the drive-thru, and my dad would take me. And then they'd be like, he'd order, and they'd be like, do you want ketchup with that? And he was like, yeah, I do. And do you know the Lord Jesus Christ is your personal savior? You know, like, this is my dad. I swear, he sold Kirby Speakers just so he could preach to God. He was like, you want to back it? Do you want to know the Lord Jesus Christ is your personal savior? So I had this idea of God that I had to have God, but I had to live by a certain set of rules. It seemed very restrictive, right? And it seemed very performative and it was loud, but that's just the way my dad lived. And so we were in church all day, every day. But I was also into sports. You know, I played baseball with the dudes until they told me I couldn't play baseball anymore. They called me Eddie, and I was really good at it. And I also lived really good. Because Eddie could strike them out. You know, Addie couldn't. You know, this is like in the 80s in West Virginia. And I love sports. And I would always be outside, you know, doing the things that we did back in the 80s. You know, you just went outside. You know, imagine that. Go outside, kids. My kids, go outside. Right? But I just love sports, and I had an easy, fairly childhood. I mean, I had a beautiful childhood. I mean, basically, I was away at church camp in the summer of 87, and I came home, and they said, your dad's in the hospital. And I was like, well, all right, that's not new, right? Because I knew the dude had cancer. And so I went to the hospital, and I went to see him in the room, and he was all hooked up to stuff. A little different, a little intense. I was like, all right, I wasn't expecting it to be this intense. But they brought me back for church camp for this. And so I was talking to my dad. I just remember laying in bed and talking to him. And the thing I can remember vividly, I was 11. It was like, his chest is very hairy. And when they take all those stickers off, that's going to hurt. Like, it's amazing what happens to, like, in the mind of an 11-year-old who's super uncomfortable. Like, what the hell is going on? And it's like, the thing I had to focus on was this hairy chest. You know, it's just what I remember. But the very next day I came back, and they told me that my dad wasn't going to live through the day, that he lived through the night, that he had fallen into a coma, and it was pretty bad. And I was like, what? Like, wait, what? Because, like, I always knew he had cancer. You know, he got cancer. You know, I had seizure every once in a while. I'd lose his voice. That's how the part of his brain had affected him so often. He'd be talking, and then all of a sudden, I swear people were like, thank God he had a seizure, shut him up. But he would like literally, and I don't mean that in bad, but my dad would always preach to you. He would be that guy, like, what about Jesus? What about Jesus? What about Jesus? And they're like, oh, Brother Tim, thank you, but like enough already. And so, because the thing is, he knew what he was going to die, what was going to kill him, right? And I think he was just so petrified of that because he was an addict and an alcoholic, and he was like us, right? And so I think he was so fearful of what he had done. And then he was 27 years old when he was diagnosed with cancer. He was 38 when he died. I thought that was old. Like, you know, I just thought that was kind of old. So anyway, he lived through the night. But my mom sent me to a friend's house until it, like, happened. He died, right? I knew that when they called me home, that meant my dad had died. And so they called me home, and I was getting ready to dive off of a friend's diving board, and I knew I was going home. They're like, Addie, it's time to go home. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, oh, my dad's dead. You know, like, whoa. And I remember walking through the house. You know, I'm like all 50 pounds soaking wet at this point. I'm 11 years old. And I'm walking through the house, and I can see my friend and her mom, like, pitying me a little bit. Like, you're just looking at me with such like pity, sad. Her dad died. You know, that's really sad. And I was like, oh, I did not want them feeling sorry for me. Like, I just put on an act. And I remember very vividly, like, the first act, the first time I was wearing a mask, pretending that I was okay when I wasn't okay. And I was like, okay, thanks, guys. And this is like a oddly, weirdly, like, sort of good mood. And you're like, her dad just died, you know. So it's not like, I just felt like I could not be what I was feeling inside because I did not know what I was feeling inside. And it felt much easier just to pretend it didn't exist. So I went home, my mom sat me on the stairs, and she told me that my dad died and whatever. And that was the only conversation we had about it. And my mom, because they did not really like each other, I think it was a gift to her that he passed away, because I think that was easier than being married to the man. And at first, as an 11-year-old, and even as I grew older, I used to resent that. And I used to be like, man, why didn't you talk about my dad to me? Why wouldn't you give me that gift? And I think it's probably one of the greatest gifts that she ever had, was that she thought it was more kind to not talk about him. Because the things he did in his disease hurt her so profoundly that, you know, like, she just, I'm not going to talk about him. But what it also, it just modeled behavior for me that you just, if something happens, it doesn't matter. You just quit talking about it, pull up your bootstraps, and you go on with life. And so I was the youngest of three kids. My mom is a school teacher. She just lost her husband. She's also 37 years old. And so we just never talked about the man, never. And so it just modeled this behavior that you don't talk about things, right? And that was sort of fine with me, but I didn't know at 11-year-old that it's totally normal to be in pain or for it to hurt when your dad dies. Like, that's normal. But, and it's not that I was trying not to, it's just that I didn't, because I didn't see it modeled. And it just didn't seem like a sort of a sad thing, but I can see now that, like, that was the first time that I was actually wounded or hurt or some type of trauma, and then I pretended like it didn't happen. And nobody in my life talked to me and was like, hey, you should share your feelings. Are you okay? Do you want to share your feelings? I think it's such a gift that I know now I can do that with my kids, that feelings are real, because those feelings that I kept bottled up, I ended up just drinking the fuck out of those feelings, because eventually they got to go somewhere. All right. Anyway, dad dies, that whole deal. Brother and sister go to college. I'm a gymnast, and so I did the type of gymnastics. Mary Lou Retton was in my little gym where I grew up. She's from the same hometown, same town in West Virginia called Fairmont. So I did gymnastics, and I did it fairly well. I did it well enough that I got a full gymnastics scholarship to Temple University. So I went from the backwoods of West Virginia to the streets of North Philadelphia, and I walked there. It was like Center City, Philly. And I was like, how? How? With this accent, it's like five syllable hello, huh? You know, they're like, what the fuck is this girl? Like, yo. And I was so happy. I was like, oh my God, cities and stoplights and red lights, and this is exciting, and people. And I loved it. So I went to Temple University on gymnastics scholarship. That went really well. And that's the very first time I tried Zima. I didn't drink at all in high school. Not at all. I thought, and like, I fit in high school. I was always liked enough, like, but I wasn't part of like the cheerleaders and the prom queens and all that shit. You know, I was just always in the gym. And so I was likable enough, and I didn't ever feel like I didn't fit in, but I didn't drink. And, you know, and so now when I started to drink alcoholically, I'm like, I didn't drink until college. I'm like, not an alcoholic, yeah, right. I'm a fucking alcoholic, you guys. I'm an alcoholic, you know, God, you're about to hear. So anyway, but that first time I had that Zima, I was like, whoa. Ooh, because I hate the taste of beer. And they're like, well, maybe should we drink the Zima? And the boy, does she drink the Zima? And I drank a lot of Zima, you know? And I look back now and I drank alcoholically from the very beginning. I didn't know how to stop. I'd be that annoying friend and be like, let's have more. Why are you going home? What are you doing? Come on. Or, you know, I'd wake up and I'd feel hungover, or it would just be some obnoxious thing. Like, we would be at a tailgate and I would have like a punching contest with my roommates. Like, we're literally like, let's see who can punch each other the most. I mean, just bizarre, insane things. It's because I'm freaking hammered, right? It's just like Gatorade and vodka. It's like more, right? And I wasn't coping with this stuff, but it like provided some relief that I didn't even know I needed. So like, oh, I just remember thinking, just like life at that point was just fun and for free. It was like, all right, the only trauma I had in my life, where I thought, was like my dad died, but nobody else made a big deal of that. So I was like, didn't really matter the fuck to me, you know, he just died. That's what happens. But it did matter because those feelings went somewhere. I just didn't know how to express them because I didn't feel safe doing that. And that wasn't modeled for me. And it's normal, guys, if your dad or somebody dies, it's normal to cry. I just want you to know. I know that now. I cry all the time now, like all the time. But that took a long time to cry. So I go through Temple and I study journalism because I just love telling stories and I love talking to people and I love the Today Show and Katie Couric. So when I finished my 5 years of competitive gymnastics, I had a 5-year scholarship, so I had another year to finish up. And at the time, the Today Show was the biggest thing on TV. It was just America's First Family and I was obsessed with it. And so I would take a little Greyhound bus to New York when I was living in Philly, just to sit outside the Today Show studios. I'm like, I want to get in there. How do I do that? And so I wrote Katie Couric a letter. I said, can I come up and spend a day with you? I'd like to see what your job's like behind me, you know, when you leave my TV every day. And she's like, all right, come up and spend the day with me. Her assistant got in touch with me. I was like, yo, for real? And she's like, yeah, for real. I'm like, oh, yo, you have no idea what you've unleashed. I'm going to stalk you until I get in that studio. But she did. She did. I would have, because I love it. But she ended up calling me in September 98. I spent the day with her at the Today Show, and she liked me enough that she was like, yeah, do you want to, you need an internship? I'm like, what's an internship? You know, I didn't know. I was just a dumb jock, you know. I was just like, what do you do? You know, because I had to live life. I had to be an adult, and I didn't really know how to do that because I was always just in the gym, you know. I was just in the gym or doing sports or something like that. So anyway, Katie said, yeah, why don't you get an internship? I was like, okay, let's do that. I'll do that. So I went to New York City in early January of 99. I did an internship and I worked so hard for free that they were like, well, if we pay this chick, she's going to work even better. And I was like, yeah. So I graduated from college in 99. And I did that internship at the Today Show, and I absolutely loved it. I just learned how to do TV, and it was just like a dream come true. I'm from the backwoods of West Virginia, you guys. Like, when I tell you, like, I mean, I'm from the holler. I'm not even from the cute parts of West Virginia. Like, and it's not like Southern cute. That's West Virginia redneck. That is so different. So here I am in New York City, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. You know, like, I wasn't afraid of life. I wanted something. I just did it. But anytime I'd feel pain or anytime I'd have a drink available to me and I would go out, I would drink alcoholically, right? So this alcohol thing that I had, it was just always a problem in my life. It didn't make life unmanageable, but it certainly made it very uncomfortable, particularly for other people, right? And so for myself, what the fuck, man? Driving and not knowing that I brought my car back, just, you know, and I wasn't waking up wondering who the fuck was beside me. But, you know, I'd wake up like, what did I do? You know, like, and just drinking until other people didn't. So I drank differently, but I wasn't coping with anything. I hadn't really been confronted with fear yet in my life. No type of fear that I couldn't handle. But I worked at the Today Show. I absolutely loved it. You know, I wanted to go and be on TV. I wanted to work my way up. I wanted to be Katie Couric. I didn't want to just follow her around and hand her scripts. So I accepted a job on air in West Virginia, where I grew up. And I took that job and I loved it. And so I swear to God, oh my God, I was making $13.5 a year, but I was on TV in the morning and in the afternoon, but I was living with my mom. I couldn't even afford bread. So I started to sell vacuum cleaners the filter queen, because I needed to make more money, right? And so here I am in West Virginia, where I grew up. These people knew me. It's a small town, you guys. I was an athlete. So it was like, I was the one superstar. But so I'm on TV, and then I'm selling him a vacuum cleaner. And this dude's like, yo, she's like, you're in my living room right now, but you were just on the TV in my living room. You know, and I'm like, dude, you have no idea. It's not as glitzy as you think, man. Like, it was coming from New York, and then being on air in West Virginia, and it's just sort of shitty, you know, it's like not great. I'm like, well, I'm having a crisis. What am I going to do? So went back to Philadelphia, where I went to college, and I saw these soldiers coming in with this place where I was waitressing and bartending. And these dudes came in uniform. They were in the Army. I was like, oh, what would it be like to go to basic training? I was at this real crossroads in my life where I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know what I wanted to be. And I didn't know anything about. I just was my first sort of depression, this like painful realization that I don't know what I want to do with my life. And it was so painful that I just felt like I needed to go run and join the Army or do something that extreme to get myself out of it. And so for the summer of 2001, I went to go see a recruiter. I didn't know anything about the Army. I just wanted to do all these obstacles and shit and put on a uniform. So like literally, I just went to a recruiter, be all you can be. I'm like, I'll do that. Let me go do that. So I went to see the recruiter, and he's like, so what do you want to do? I'm like, I don't know, be in the Army. And he's like, okay, he's like, you have to have a job. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm like, well, I don't know. It seems like a big deal, big, you know, commitment, but I could do it in the reserve. He's like, kind of a big deal. And my mom's like, what the fuck is happening to you? Why are you joining the Army? What are you talking about? I'm like, I don't know. It sounds like fun. Then 9/11 happened, right? And that's like, oh, that's a whole new ball game. But something in my soul said, just gotta join the Army, gotta do it. So found out you could be a journalist in the Army and then be in the reserve, and it could complement my civilian career. And I was, man, at this point in my life, I was drinking my face off. Like, I would waitress all day, and then I'd sit at the bar, and they would give me a Smirnoff ice, you know, and then I'd drink a little bit of it, and then they'd top it off with the Smirnoff raspberry. And just absurd amount of alcohol, right? And just complete oblivion all the time. And I was drinking to cope at that point because, like, I was in a lot of pain, right? And so I decided that I had to get away from everyone and everything. And I joined the Army. I signed up. I went in March of 2002. I joined the Army, went off to basic training, and I found out you could be a journalist in the Army. So I was like, well, that's what I want to do. So I went to basic training. I loved it, man. But I swear those drill sergeants were like, hey, Army Barbie. They called me Army Barbie. They thought I was there in like a movie set or something. And I was like, no, dude, this is like for real. You have no, I'm so fucked up. You have no idea. You know? I was like, the job there, they're supposed to break you down. I'm like, I'm fucking broken, dude. Like, I'm broken. Like, I just got to go back up, you know? And the Army did that. It gave me some discipline. It gave me a little bit of structure. It was team, you know, it was like a team camaraderie thing. And I was a gymnast. So I love that shit. And so I did really well at it. I was good at it. In fact, Army Barbie got soldier of the cycle. Yeah, right. I took that one drill sergeant. Like, now what, bitch? Now what? You know, but I loved it. I thrived in that environment. I needed somebody to tell me what to do. That's why I like Carrie so much. I need somebody to tell me what the fuck to do. I do. Yeah, she is like soldier. You're all my battle buddies. You are. You're all my battle buddies. But anyway, I went to basic training. Then I studied journalism in the Army as well, the whole deal. And it was awesome. I was like, okay, I'm in the fucking Army, man. And so I, after that, I packed up my car and drove here, moved to California. A girlfriend of mine had moved here. And I ended up in Huntington Beach, and I was working at Starbucks until I could get a full-time job. And I eventually got a full-time job at Access Hollywood, you know, TV show. It's an NBC show. My buddy Al Roker recommended me for that gig. And I got a job at Access Hollywood, and I loved it. And 3 months later, they're like, hey, you want to our rap? I'm like, oh, okay. Kind of liking this Access Hollywood thing. Like, it's over it. But in November of 2003, I found myself in rap. And I'd never been out of the country. I had been over to see you guys in California before when I lived in West Virginia, but that's as far as I had gotten. And then all of a sudden, here I am, I'm in Iraq, and I'm in a war zone. And I'm like, ooh, gosh. And, you know, you just step off that plane. And I got there right after the initial invasion. So it was November 2003. And that's when things were unfolding. Like, we had to go set up a radio and TV station, sort of like Good Morning Vietnam, except it's like Good Morning Baghdad. And I did radio and television. I was Mountain Mama, guys. Mountain Mama on the radio, 4 hours for half of my tour. Yeah, I was Mountain Mama. And I would just, that's right, take me home, Country Roads. Well, I was in Iraq, and that was not Country Roads, you know. But the first 6 months I was there, I did TV. And so when we got there, we were still set up in Saddam's palace. So we're sleeping in Saddam's palace, and it was like less than a week. And all of a sudden, I'm jolted off the bed, and it was that first attack. That there was a car bomb that exploded right outside the gate, and it literally bolted me out of my bed. And they told me because we had a camera, we need to go outside, document it for the investigation. And I literally had been in country a little bit less than a week. And I walked out there, and thank God I had that camera as my physical barrier between me and the reality of what I was living and seeing. Because what I saw there was absolute horror, right? And like, our bodies have this unbelievable capacity to shut down completely. And thank God I already have that function, because my dad died and it's like it never happened, right? Like, any feelings that I had, it didn't matter. But thank God I had that camera. Because for me, that was the thing that separated me from the truth of what I was living. And I had only been there for a week, and I had a year to go. It's like, I mean, I didn't even shoot a BB gun in West Virginia, guys. And that's like sacrilege. If you are living in West Virginia and you don't shoot a BB gun, like, I'm not a real redneck, right? Like, I don't have my stripes. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing weapons and mortars and artillery and car bombs. And it's like, oh, what the fuck? How did I get here? But I got there because I was escaping one trauma or one pain, and I went and ran to the next, right? Because I didn't have any tools to cope at all. But we made friends with some of the Navy SEALs there, and I got lost. And we were like, serving their country. Love them, but they also got alcohol. Because they were sort of special forces, and they put on civilian clothes. So I remember, it was like, I remember some of it. Like March and April, you know, and this is March and April of 2004. And I was there until November 2004. But I ended up drinking in a week. I mean, that's alcoholic, right? Like, that's not safe, guys. I would not, you know, recommend, but I did. And I put myself in a lot of dangerous situations, in an already dangerous situation. But that's my disease. Like, as soon as I got that relief, God, I mean, that drink, I was like, oh, God. When I drink, it gives me permission to feel what I should be feeling as a human being. We are supposed to feel feelings, people. But that was not something that like, was normal to me. And it's not that I didn't want to. I just had no idea how to process them once I did. And so if I felt pain or rejection or fear, whatever, man, fear had its way with me. And when fear finally had its way with me, I was just drinking and drinking and drinking, because I could not deal with not being able to like be a normal adult, right? Like, just function with pain, you know? And so all it does is start chipping away at my confidence, right? And who I think I am and what I can do, go to the Today Show, join the Army, do the ship, but I can't deal with the minute bit of fear. Right? Courage and fear are so different. Like, I can put on a uniform, I can go to war, but I cannot tell you what I'm feeling because I can't access that shit. It's so deeply buried in me, and I had to go somewhere, right? And eventually, like I said, I would go to a bottle because I had to have relief. So I would drink just so that I could feel or give myself permission to cry. So anyway, I got through that tour duty, but it was like, it's brutal, you know, it's a war zone, and I'm a journalist in the Army, so my job is to tell stories. So I carry an M16 and a camera, and I love what I do, but I also met a lot of Iraqis, saw a lot of destruction, saw a lot of pain. I saw the inhumanity and the humanity of war, and it can either harden you or it can humanize you. And for me, it did both, but mostly it hardened me. It shut me down, almost feels like constitutionally, right? And when you come home, you cannot just be like, well, I want to love. Yeah, I want to be nice, and I want to do this if you're shut down, right? So I would just mask, and I had no idea. Came home from that first tour, met my now husband. He was not my husband yet, but I met him. I have a husband. Yes, he's my husband, and now he's not, so he's my husband. And I know, he was cute. Well, I was not cute, but that's fine. But I met him right after my first tour. We met his roommates, the whole thing. We got married, loved this guy. He's great, you know. And I, when I say I loved him, I know what real love is now. Like, I know what real love is, and I found him in the rooms of AA. I don't know if I ever really had a capacity to love because I wasn't modeled it. I didn't know what that looked like for real. I didn't feel safe loving people. Like, I don't think I did. Because I know, like I said, I know what real love is, but I loved him as much as I could then at the time. I was damaged for more. I had no idea I was damaged because I present well, and I know I present well, right? And I'm like, yeah, I'm a patriot. I'm a hero, right? I'm any of those things. I wasn't. But it certainly felt good to say I am, and I felt accomplished. Like I had built myself back up, but really I hadn't built myself up. It's just there was no foundation. So it was just bound to crumble, and it did eventually. But married this man, 3 months later, got told I was getting ready to go to Iraq again. I got to go back for my second tour, and this was during the surge. So that tour, I was with the 3rd Infantry Division, and it was a particularly violent tour. And in February of 2008, we were at a school, and it was a civil affairs mission, and we were handing out backpacks to kids there in Iraq who don't have anything. I mean, man, the things that they had to suffer through. If I ever complain, oh my God, I just, perspective is huge. Is what they were living. And these kids who we were talking to, handing out backpacks. And so my job in the Army is to go tell their story, and I would interview them and, you know, look, we're winning hearts and minds and shit, right? It's like, tell the soldier story and then tell about these Iraqis who love us. And I was like, I don't know, but these Iraqi kids did love us and I loved them. And just as we were wrapping up that mission, a bomb exploded behind that school. And these kids who I was literally just talking to, I was stepping over parts of. And I went, and again, like your body just shuts down. And in that moment, it was like, you got to get to the, you know, to the rally zone because like, yo, I'm basically trained. You don't want me in there when the shit's going crazy, right? So it's like, all right, camera person, all right, little soldier journalist, like you get the fuck out and make it worse here, right? So like we roll out and then the quick reaction force comes in and we leave that scene and it's like, it never happened. It's like, it never happened. And for me, it's like, never happened. We did not need to be held accountable for anything. I was not accountable for anything. Where did that pain go? It was stored somewhere. It had to go somewhere, right? I came home May 12th, 2008. So May 12th, 2007, I got married. May 12th, 2008, I came home from Iraq. May 12th, 2009, I had my first son. So it's like a marker that I can mark time with, right? And when I came back, the person who married Greg, his name is Greg, the person who married Greg did not come back. So he could not access me and I had no idea. And when I first came home that first night, we went to Trader Joe's and we got some wine and we were laying on the couch and he had fallen asleep and we'd share one glass of wine. And so he didn't know me as like an alcoholic. Like I would drink and maybe, you know, not remember how I got home or I'd be like, didn't remember the cab ride. But Greg did not know the alcoholic that I am. When I came home from that tour, he had some wine, we shared that bottle and then I went and cracked open another bottle. And he was like, oh, you're going to have another one? And I was like, oh yeah, I guess I am. Right. It's like, when he went to sleep, I could not cope with what's going on in my head. Like I left Iraq, but I did not leave the war. I brought it home with me. And again, it was all up here, but they talk about post-traumatic stress syndrome when you're traumatized, like post means that it literally can manifest or be triggered at any time. Right. And so I was just drinking more because I was coping more. I went back to work at Access Hollywood. So I appreciated being able to cover fucking Britney Spears because I was just covering that school. Right. So it was like a welcome reprieve. I was like, yeah, you know, Britney Spears shaves her head. Get on the scene. You know, Nick Lachey, I asked him about his marriage. He was in a show called Newlyweds, by the way. And I went when the marriage went to shit. I asked him a question about it and he got mad at me. I'm like, did you ever think called Newlyweds? Like, come on. Right. It was about marriage. And then I remember Nick Lachey yelling at me and he's like, what, a D-list boy bander? And I'm like, oh my God. Like, yeah, Peter's brother. I'm like, this is my job, yo. You know, you're on the red carpet. I'm asking questions. You should be lucky I have a microphone in front of you. But I was like, yeah, I don't think I can do this anymore. Nick Lachey just fucking yelled at me. He's not even NSYNC or Backstreet Boys. He's fucking like, give me a break, dude. But like I've grown sort of like tired of that nonsense because I was still in Iraq, right? Like I was home, but I was still in Iraq. So anyway, I came back, had my kids, May 12th, 2009, I had my son Hudson, who's now 16. 19 months later, I had my daughter Hartley. And I swear to God, Hartley should have purple eyes, you guys. Like I was so stressed out dealing with Hudson that when I was pregnant with my daughter, I dreamed blind. You know, I do these things that now I don't like to admit, but in these rooms I can, because you guys know, do the same things. And you know, if you tell that young girl that you'd be drinking while you're pregnant with your daughter, I'd be like, oh no, because you know, oh my God, you imagine in my church, if you drive your daughter, like you go to hell, right? Because that was my idea, right? Like, oh my God. But I would do these things when I would drink that are just so unsafe and awful. And Greg was out working. We created a nonprofit called Pro vs. G.I. Joe, where we set up video game competitions between professional athletes and celebrities and troops stationed all over the world. And so while I was in Iraq, he set that up. And then when we came back, we did that together. So like that was our first baby together. And so he'd be out hustling. It's a nonprofit. He's doing his deal. And here I am with our son, pregnant with his daughter, and I'm drinking. Right, he has no idea that I'm the damage I'm probably doing to our daughter. Now she came out, she's normal, whatever normal is, you know. Yeah, I love her. She's 14 and a half. Her name is Hartley. She's awesome. But as soon as the Hartley was born, all of a sudden at night I could not sleep. I was having these nightmares and all these, you know, these kids, these memories and these things that I had thought I put away or just did not access started to flood back. And I didn't understand what was going on. I couldn't sleep. I got two kids under two. We're running the business together. We're out here in California. I don't have any family here. Like literally we have no family. The closest family member I have is my brother in Michigan. We barely talk. I mean, I love him, but we barely talk. So it's like, I had no one here. But you know what I did get? Wine. Because in Orange County, and you're an Orange County housewife, there's always wine. I was like, yeah, I love that wine. And I love that Adderall. Ooh, man, Someone introduced me to Adderall, and I was like, thank you. Okay, no more pain, no more tired, no more nothing, right? And my girlfriend, Melanie, had no idea what she had just offered me, because there weren't signs that I'm alcoholic, that I needed something. But it was this perfect storm of like, I'm a new mom. I'm dealing with some trauma. I got some shit going on. I can't sleep. I know what Carrie's telling me. I got this month's sponsor says, hurry the fuck up, Patty. All right, so anyway. Adderall and wine, all right? There's the story. When I would drink, I drink way, way, way too much. I'd cause a lot of damage. I was also dealing with a lot of PTSD. Jails, institutions of death. When I came into AA and I heard about them, I'm like, yep, been on the whole tour. And that started literally jails, institutions, and death. So my disease was progressive, you guys. And from very early on, I knew I was in a lot of trouble. I was hiding things. So the drug is to talk about, but also wine. And I would go to the VA, be like, I got this. They'd be like, take this. And I'd be like, okay, but this. And I need more. So then I had a friend who would get me more, right? So spending my money, separating from my husband, having no, you know, he has no idea what's going on. I'm blaming it on PTSD, but what it is just alcoholism and withdrawal, I'm like shaking. And I'm like, I'm so traumatized. It's like, no, I need my fix, right? I'm sick. But how do I say that to him? I'm spiraling, but I can't keep up with it. And so in August of 2012, I needed to pay for my dry goods before I paid for my car registration. So I went and took somebody else's registration, put it on my car. And then when I got pulled over, leaving Laguna Beach, you know, they ran the tags. They're like, oh, this girl's not paying her registration. So he pulled me over. And I also had a warrant because I had ran a red light up in LA when I was going to go get some good stuff from my army buddy of mine. And I didn't pay that because I wasn't paying attention to things in my life at all. I was basically paying attention to my kids. I was separated from my husband, you know, emotionally completely. And all I needed was that solution that I needed. It was in the pill and it was in the bottle. And I got arrested. I got a felony. So there's the jail, right? So here I am. I'm like cute, looking all cute, Norm, you know, in Newport Beach. And I go to the clink and they call him like, yo, you got to come bail her out. He's like, what the hell? So you got to come bail me out. And then in 2013, I mean, that's just the whole spiral. Institutions, oh my God. I had to go to court for this felony that I had, but I didn't tell them anything about it. So I'm at the courthouse and I was supposed to be there at 9 o'clock. And they're like, nope, come back after lunch. You got to leave. So I left. I'm like, oh my God, I'm really uncomfortable with where I am and what I've done. I don't know how to talk to anybody about this. So you know what I need? Go to the gas station, get some Microsoft lemonade. That'll make it better. So I sit in the parking lot of the courthouse at Harbor Center. On Jamboree, and I just drank myself silly for like an hour. I was so hammered. And I was so emotional. I started crying. I took one of the bottles, opened it up. I broke it on the cement out there, and I just started going on town on my wrist. And I wasn't, it wasn't like a real suicide attempt, but it was like this release of this pressure. It was like I had to break my skin and was just overwhelmed with my trauma, but also my behavior and my lies and my drinking and my disease. Like, this is alcoholism on display. And it was such a scene that I actually called my girlfriend Melanie because I scared myself. And I was, and she's like, called the ambulance and the break came. And then you should have seen the scene in the courtroom. They was like, oh my God, we did not expect all this after lunch. What the hell? So I'm sitting there in my uniform. Thank you. I'm sitting there in my uniform. And he's like, no, this girl needs a treatment. She needs to go to treatment. She doesn't need jail. She needs help. So I went to the VA and I was on the psych ward at the VA for about a month. And the psychiatrist was like, we think you might be alcoholic. And I'm like, no. He's like, you're powerless over alcohol. I mean, look at your life. And I'm like, powerless? What do you mean? Knowledge is power. And I mean, that's the thing. Right? Yeah, knowledge is power. Meanwhile, like, I cannot be trusted with scissors, right? And I'm telling this guy, knowledge is power. Imagine thinking that I had control when the door's locked from the outside, right? And I'm telling this guy that I have some type of control. And that's where my disease took me. Jails, institutions, and near death. I wasn't safe enough to go home, but Greg did not trust me either to be with our children. And I could not be trusted with my daughter. So all I had to do was stay put in my room, but I couldn't even do that. So I got hammered in my room. And then I thought it'd be great to climb out the window and go to the VA, because that's where my secrets were out. And I felt safe there. Crawled out of the window, and I was going to get on the terrace below, but the terrace wasn't there because I'm fucking hammered. This is what we do, you guys. This is what we do. I fell into the brick patio below. I broke my clavicle. I broke six broken ribs, collapsed lung, and a broken pelvis. Yeah, that's where my disease takes me. I only have 741 days of sobriety. That was in January 2014. This disease is progressive, and I drank and drank and drank until everybody in my life was so sick of me. It didn't matter what kind of trauma I have, and I would pull that shit out all the time. I'd pull that out. I'm like, I've got PTSD, you know, because I knew that manipulation, you'd feel sorry for me. I could throw that up. I know it. And it wasn't until I met Carrie and she called that shit out that I realized that I'm weaponizing and cheapening a real thing just to get you off my back so I could keep causing more pain and more pain. In April of 2018, I was in another sleepaway camp. Oh, by the way, I got better, I recovered, but I had 2 months of like inpatient physical rehabilitation. From there, I just realized though, like, I'm working so hard to get my physical health back. Why wouldn't I work that hard to get my emotional health back, right? But that means I have to surrender, and I did not want to surrender because I don't want to be an alcoholic. I do not want to be an alcoholic. I'm so much more than that. And I didn't want to surrender, but in April 2018, I went to the Canyon Club because I was in another sleepaway camp asking for help I wouldn't participate in. And this woman who was sitting at that table raised her hand and she said, she shared something. I found my God that night and I had no idea he was through to another alcoholic. I went and asked somebody for her phone number and they said, who, the lady sitting in the corner? I'm like, yeah, that lady in white linen. She looked like an angel or whatever. She did. She looked like an angel to me. And they're like, oh, that's Carrie. I'm like, okay. And she's... I'm like, okay, I don't know what that means. That means she didn't fuck around. She did not fuck around. She got K-Fuck Radio, but this woman does recovery, right? But something, I don't know what she said, but the God in me took that first real step towards actual recovery, not sobriety, recovery. I went and asked somebody for her phone number. That was a power greater than me. I did not do that. I had no idea. I wasn't paying attention really to what you guys were saying. I was just there because I wanted people to get off my back, and you said I should get there. So I asked Carrie to be my sponsor. She says, listen, girl, I am too busy. I do not do drugs. So if you're not done drinking, I cannot help you. I am too busy. And let me tell you, she is so busy, you guys. And I did drunk. I did drunk a lot. I'd say I want help. And then, you know, I would go and drink. And then she'd call me or I'd call her. She'd probably call me. And she'd be like, are you ready? And I'm like, yeah. Are you done? Yeah. But that was shame talking. It wasn't really. I had no idea. I had 3 years of sobriety, but I really only had sobriety. I was dry drunk. I'd come in here. I was like the Drake of AA. I was like the culture vulture. I would come in and take you guys. Yeah, I was. I was just leeching. I was just taking, right? You guys are K-Doc, right? And he's got like this music and substance and it's an artistry, right? There's soul in what he does. And that's what I feel like you guys do with AA. Carrie, that's what she does with AA. Like, she really walks this path. Me, I'm just going to take from you guys, right? I'm manufactured, I'm fake. So when push comes to shove, just like Drake, when you're confronted with the truth about yourself, you're going to fall. And I drank every single time because I didn't have a solution, right? I know I talk about this beef, but I feel like I was a culture vulture in AA. Like, I was the Drake of AA because I took your guys' truth because I didn't have one. But that is, I couldn't admit I'm alcoholic. And I've got another drink in April 2023 after 3 years of sobriety. And I drank all day, every day. And I got to a place where I was so desperately afraid of myself, but I still could not call this woman who had stood by me for now 5 years. I couldn't say, hey, yo, I tried. I did this. Like, again, I'm not courageous. I've been to war twice, nothing to do with courage. I could not open up to another alcoholic because I didn't know how to. I didn't know how to. And then I felt such shame. And talk about a God. I didn't need that fucking scary God, because that God was going to damn me to hell. Because if all I had to do was sin when I was a little girl, hell, the fuck am I going to explain? I'm falling out of windows. I'm causing chaos. I mean, I don't have to tell you how much money I spent. Like, the things I did to my now husband, yeah, that's why he's my husband. That's part of it. I had a huge part to play in that. But, like, he couldn't access me. And eventually I had to just set the man free, right? Because I could not show up for him the way he needed to. And then I like drugs and alcohol more than I wanted to be with my husband or work on that. I did not have the capacity. I didn't have the willingness. I wasn't willing to work for anything in my life. I was just coasting. Remember I told you I was, when my dad died, I was walking through, I just sort of take him. It's like, I've been playing a role my whole life. You know, I'm an athlete, I'm a soldier, I'm a journalist, do this, you know, and I could take a chip in AA and I know I could string some words together about, you know, but it's just bullshit because it's your solution. I turned it into my share, but I had no defense. So when I went out to drink, I didn't have a power greater than me that would help me not do that. And I just drank myself into oblivion. And Carrie knew I was drinking. She was like, okay. I was like, no, I just said, you know, because we don't buy it. Yeah. Like, you sure? I'm like, what's the therapy? What's the therapy at the VA? I'm pulling that shit because I'm drinking all day, every day. Like, the middle of the night thinking I'm going through the change. I'm almost 50. Like, I'm in my mid-40s. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sweaty. Is this the change? Like, no, you're an alcoholic. You need some vodka. So, like, yeah, that's not the change, Addie. You know what I mean? You know, no, I was drinking all day, every day. Disease is progressive. They talk about in the book that the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to stop, no matter the necessity or wish. I could not love my kids enough to stop drinking. I was drinking and driving with them. Ordeal. June 2023, it all came to a head. Carrie told me I had to be at a meeting. I did show up at that meeting. So the husband had to get in his car, come over and save me. And he intercepted me as I was pulling out of my car to go get that meeting. I didn't even know I was in the car. I was probably going to drive to my death or somebody else's. And if it wasn't that day, it'd be another day, because I was drinking and driving every fucking day. And I couldn't tell this woman who has loved me in this unique way, this woman who's alcoholic just like me, the woman who hears about alcoholics all the time, I did not trust her enough because I trust myself. I didn't love her enough because I love myself. And I didn't have a power greater than me to help me do that. I had no capacity. And I wanted to die, but I would not kill myself. I wanted to die. So I got to a place, I went to Ashland. Within 90 minutes, her sponsor, Judy, was like, get her to Ashland. And they're like, okay. So that wasn't like, oh, you take a bat out of hell getting me to Ashland. He's like, this fucking woman, she's not even my wife anymore. And I'm still doing this shit. You know? And thank goodness. I'm so grateful to him. I made my amends. I made my amends for that man. And you know, we had a decent relationship, but I hurt him, hurt my kids, hurt myself. But I went into Ashland and I just finally surrendered. And I don't know what it is. Ashland's the first place I've been to where they focus that primary purpose. We are responsible for lending our hand to the other alcoholic. Literally, what Gary had been doing for me for 5 years, that was so fucking selfish, I could not see it. Right? This woman who got nothing back from me showed up on me over and over and over. She said she didn't do drugs, she did drunk. And I'm so grateful she did drunk, because she fulfilled her primary purpose and she showed me what real unconditional love. She modeled that behavior I didn't get in my house. And she did it with me. And I couldn't stand myself at that point, but this woman loved me. And then I was so afraid I was losing her that I thought she was gonna be like, yo, peace out, you do not trust me. Like, this is the one drunk too much. You know, and I got to Ashland and I remember calling her. It's like scared to death. I'm like, this is weird. What are these feelings? Like, I'm not used to being afraid to call somebody. Like, my husband and I separated. I'm like, yo, deuces. Like, no skin off my back. Like, not there. Shut down. Right? No feelings. It was like, later in. But then I was afraid of losing Carrie. And I remember I called her. And she picked up. I was like, please just tell me you love me. I was like begging this woman to love me because I was so afraid of losing her. And all of a sudden, like, loss has meaning. Like, that's going to hurt me. Oh, my God. I saw my humanity. And it only took drinking myself to complete fucking destruction, right? But that's where my disease took me. It takes what it takes. And all she said to me, she's like, Addie, of course I love you. But all she said, you need to quit lying to me. I got a minute. Okay, let me wrap this up. She said, you need to quit lying to me. I'm like, okay. And I don't know what it was, you guys. Like, I was contacted by power greater than me, that this love that I experienced, this human being, helped me discover my humanity. Right, the shit that was either buried in Iraq or buried with my dad or buried with all the other excuses I come up with, fell out of that window, where the fuck, you know, my humanity went, I found it that day, June 12, 2023. I am so grateful for every fucking drink I took, but I could have killed myself and somebody, and thank God I didn't get there. So if you're new and you're not one, you're wondering, like, what the hell am I doing here? How can this girl talk with this woman? Girl, I feel like a woman's a girl. How can this chick like talk about this program with such passion. Like, yo, I'm the same way. I would roll my eyes at me if, like, over 2 years ago, I was listening to me talk. Like, I fucking love this program. I love AA. I walked all the way in. I sit all the way down. I do this shit. The words, they pop out of the book. I love it. The fellowship will grow up around you, say, you know, and you experience life revolutionized. And like, I have been, and I'm so fucking cynical. It's like the first time I've been in love, I found it in the rooms of AA. I have met my destiny to place someone to avoid it. I know how to live by a set of principles today that this woman has shown me. Her primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics for fun and for free, right? For free. And that's that, like, unburdened, unmotivated, the most beautiful love I've ever had in my life. It has power greater than me that came in and took me to that place. And that's how I found my God. It manifested the rooms of AA. I do this program, 741 days of actual recovery. I do not lie anymore. I'm basically KDOT, you guys. Like, you know, I'm Kendrick here. And my sobriety has depth and weight. There's substance in what I'm doing. You know, there's like, I'm no more drinking. Like, I can't fake it. And I cry and cry. And I cry, you guys, I cry so much. So all those years I say it goes somewhere, it goes somewhere. And now it's coming out. It's coming out. And all these feelings, but it feels good. It's like, I'm alive. I am alive. Life is not easy, but I'm held accountable. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor too. I'm so grateful for Ashlyn. I'm so grateful. I cannot believe there's a place like that that exists. And that ladies show up all the time. And I see a bunch of my Ashlyn ladies here. And I see a bunch of people in the meetings with that. I swear I was in the meeting with you for like 5 years, and I didn't even know you were in the room. Literally, I see you all the time. And then suddenly in 2023, because I woke the fuck up, I woke up and I started paying attention to something other than myself. My own bullshit, my own excuses, my own woe is me bullshit. And now I can confront those things that are very real, but I don't have to cheapen them anymore to justify shitty behavior. I have a God who loves me today that in the rooms of AA is all inclusive, never exclusive, not going to damn me to hell. It's going to say, you're feeling like shit? Come on in here. You're the most important person in the world. That's the God I wish I would have been introduced to growing up. And I hope it's the God that my dad is living with today. I hope he sees that God, the one I found in the rooms of AA through other people. If you're struggling, you are in the right place. If you're the most important in every room, just keep coming back to these rooms for fun and for free. Thanks.